because they are recording the sessions, they want me to say that I'm Richard Swanson, and as near as I can tell, it's the 11th of June?
Correct.
In 2008, and I'm working with creation stories, origin stories. And now they can figure out, when they have the tape of this thing, where in the world this happened and who in the world was here. Few words before we start. Thank you again. I see many faces from yesterday and some faces not. So just a couple of words of introduction. We are going to be playing around. That is intentionally, this is an intentionally playful session. It is intentionally, I want to emphasize that, because what we are going to be doing is looking at, through this whole week, stories from other cultures, cultures of which I am not a part, cultures that speak languages I do not speak, cultures, in fact, that I know a thimbleful about, and sometimes a small thimbleful about. And it is important, therefore, when we begin, to say that and know that and honor that. We are picking up stories and we are looking at them next to biblical stories. We are doing that so that we can knock the two of them together and see if they make interesting sparks that don't get made when you just look at biblical stories by themselves. We are, however, borrowing stories from cultures of which we are not a part. And whenever you borrow, you must, in fact, recognize that it's not the same thing as getting a gift that you get to keep, but it is a gift that you get to take care of. When we pick it up, we will pick it up and make such sense as we are able to make. It will not be full and complete sense. When we pick it up and play with it, we will, in fact, look at it and make mistakes with it and about it. I hope, let's open the circle so we can get a single layer. What I hope for is that as we pick up these stories, receive them as loans. And if there are more coming that we know about, let's put a chair in now.
Yeah. Well, my sister may show up.
And in a minute or two, we'll be as far back out as we used to be. Yeah, you know. That's the aerobic portion of this course. What I hope for, as we pick up stories that have been loaned to us and look at them, understanding and misunderstanding, I hope that we come out having found new ways to look at the stories that are native for Jews and Christians. I hope that we discover things that, in fact, are in some ways surprising. I hope also that we discover, by the time we're done, that in some very important ways, even the stories that seem native to us as Christians, as Jews, I hope we discover that those stories are in some significant ways also foreign to us and have been loaned to us. That surely is important for Christians because we are picking up in all of the stories that we'll be looking at out of biblical material these 2 weeks. All of those stories are in fact Jewish stories. And as a Gentile Christian, I pick them up as someone who has been lent them. So perhaps the disciplines that we learn to practice, picking up the stories from cultures that we know only a little about, will carry over to our picking up of biblical stories, because they also are written in a language that not all of us read well, and I read only sort of well, and they come to us out of a world in which none of us could live, because none of us is an ancient Jew. So, with that preamble, if I could ask you to do what we did yesterday, we'll go around the circle this way just for variety, even though it doesn't matter. What I'd like you to do is when you get your piece of paper, would you tell the group your name and tell the group where you are at home? Now, you could decide that means where do you live when you're not here, but you could decide that it means something else. As, for instance, I have decided, my name is Richard Swanson, and I'm at home in a good argument.
My name is Carol Hanley, and I'm at home in a delicious meal.
I'm Larry Huff, and I'm at home in the midst of music.
I'm Gundula Huff, and Van Holden is my second home.
My name is Gail Johnson, and I am at home right here.
I'm Patty Osterholm, and I'm at home, and I'm hiking in the mountains.
Have to be corny or something, but I'm Sandy Jackson, and I feel most at home, I guess, in my father's, heavenly father's presence.
My name is Mark Johnson, and I'm at home refereeing a high school football game on a Friday night.
My name is Sigmund. I am at home running his ministry.
Judy Johansson. I'm at home in the middle of a good book.
Karen Haynes, and I'm at home on a cabin near the beach.
Mike Crane. I'm at home with an iced soy latte.
I'm Nick Martin, and I am most at home when I am in a philosophical conversation.
I'm Dean Speck, and I'm at home when I ride a bicycle.
I'm Justin Cannon, and I'm at home in nature.
I'm Carolyn Albert, and I am at home whenever I'm with people I can call family.
I'm Roy Satry. I'm at home when I can be part of a lively discussion on nearly any topic.
I'm Larry Crosby, and I'm home with my wife and my children.
I'm Sue Touche, and I'm at home when I'm around children.
And I'm Jay Reinhardt, and I spend most at home when I'm up in the mountains reading a book about philosophy, sipping a soy latte.
Next year.
I thought I'd get them all in, but I ran out of ideas.
I'm Dorothy Satry, and I'm at home working with organization groups, planning groups.
I'm Molly LaFontaine. It's hard for me to decide where I'm most at home because I grew up in the woods, and I'd say I still am in the woods, but I do lose myself in a painting on canvas.
I'm Andrew Buggy, and I'm most at home working on the farm.
I'm Liz Rossing, and I'm most at home with family and friends.
I'm Zach Swanson, and I'm most at home in a good strategy game.
Okay, we are this week looking at origin stories. I said yesterday that term, origin story, is in fact better for what we're up to than creation story, because in fact some of the stories, for instance, the one we'll look at on Friday, has no creator at all. And to call them creation stories is to skew the evidence from the very beginning. One of the things you learn when you pick up these gift stories, loan stories, is that the terms we bring to them from the start sometimes make them into things that they are not. So, we're talking about origin stories. However, as you will discover in a very short while, though we are talking about origin stories, and though I spent my first session Monday evening talking about stories and how they work, what we have here is not apparently a story. We really need to figure out why that is. It's possible that it's because I'm a lunatic. That would not be the first time that's been suggested in my life. But it's also possible that there's something narrative behind this that we can scare out into the open. I am thrilled for the chance to hunt this with you. I had a great deal of fun yesterday, and the reputation of Holden conversation groups is very strong and very positive, and in my experience already so far, very well deserved. So let's begin hunting together. What I would like to do with this is what we did yesterday. I want to do a read around to get this piece out into the air. What we will do is each of us will read until we hit a punctuation mark. Any kind of punctuation mark, when you hit one, stop. And once you hit a punctuation mark, the story, the text, goes to the person immediately to your right. So I'll read until I hit something punctuational, and then you do the same. If we could, let's try again to do three laps. That takes a while, but it gets this thing fully in the air and fully in our ears. The first time, I would like you very, very much to read as quickly as you can, to simply get this thing zipping around. If possible, speak your lines as quickly as you can clearly, and start your line as soon as you can after the person next to you is finished. Finished means they've started the last word. If you try to start talking when they are starting the last word, your voice will be going when they finish their last word. Let's get this sucker to spin around this room. Second time around, I would like you to try to make it big. Speak it with some emotion. The emotion on the second lap does not have to make sense. Just try to make it big, or really small, or really anything other than flat and ordinary. Third time around, make it fast, make it big, and try to connect with the energy that's coming around the circle at you. What will that sound like? I don't know. We haven't done it yet. Okay. We will begin, we will go this way around. When we finish the first lap, which by the way will require you to turn the paper and read two lines at the top of the back, and then turn back and start again at the beginning. Okay? So when you hear all the paper flapping, flap yours too, and then flap back. Here we go. Some foolish men declare the Creator made the world.
The doctrine that the world is created is ill-advised.
And should be rejected.
If God created the world, where was he before creation?
If you say he was transcendent, then...
And needed no support.
Where is he now?
No single being had the skill to make this world.
For how can an immaterial God create that which is material?
How could God have made the world without any raw material? If you say he made this first,
and then the world,
you are faced with an endless regression.
If you declare that this raw material arose naturally, you fall into another fallacy.
The whole universe might thus have been its own creator and have arisen equally with natural.
If God created the world by an act of his own will,
without any raw material,
then it is just his will and nothing else.
And who will believe this silly stuff?
If he is ever perfect and complete,
how could the will to create have arisen in him?
If
on the other hand,
he is not perfect.
He could no more create the universe than a potter could.
If he is formless, actionless,
and all-embracing,
how could he have created the world?
Such a soul,
devoid of all modality,
would have no desire to create anything.
If he is perfect, he does not strive for the three aims of man.
So what advantage would he gain by creating the universe?
If you say that he created to no purpose.
Because it was his nature to do so.
Then God is pointless. If he created in some kind of sport.
It was the sport of a foolish child.
Leading to trouble.
If he created because of the karma of embodied beings acquired in a previous creation, he is not the Almighty Lord.
But subordinate to something else.
If out of love for living things and need of them made the world.
Why did he not make creation wholly blissful?
Free from misfortune.
If he were transcendent, he would not create.
For he would be free.
Nor if involved in transmigration.
For then he would not be almighty.
Thus the doctrine that the world was created by God makes no sense at all.
And God commits great sin in slaying the children whom he himself created.
If you say that he says only to destroy evil beings,
why did he create such a being in the first place?
Good man should combat the believer in divine creation,
maddened by evil doctrine.
Know that the world is uncreated, as time itself is.
Without beginning and end.
And is based on the principles.
Life and the rest.
Uncreated and indestructible. It endures under the compulsion of its own nature.
Divided into three sections.
Hell, earth, and heaven.
Earth,
heaven.
Some foolish men declare that the Creator made the world.
doctrine that the world was created is ill advised.
And should be rejected.
If God created the world,
where was he before creation?
If you say he was transcendent, then.
And needed no support,
where is he now?
No single being had the skill to make the world.
How can an immaterial God create that which is material?
How could gods have made the world without any raw material?
If you say he made this first, and then the world,
you are faced with an endless progression.
If you declare that this raw material arose naturally, you fall into another fallacy.
For the whole universe might thus have been its own creator,
and have arisen equally naturally.
If God created the world by an act of his own will,
without any raw material, then it is just his will and nothing else.
And who will believe this silly stuff?
If he is ever perfect and complete,
how could the will to create have arisen in him?
If,
on the other hand,
he is not perfect,
he could create no more than create the universe than a potter could.
If he is formless,
actionless,
and all embracing,
how could he have created the world?
Such a soul,
devoid of all modality,
would have no desire to create anything.
If he is perfect,
he does not strive for the three aims of man.
So what advantage would he gain by creating the universe?
If you say that he created to no purpose,
because it was his nature to do so,
then God is pointless.
If he created in some kind of sport,
it was the sport of a foolish child,
leading to trouble. If he created because of the karma of embodied beings acquired in a previous creation, he is not the Almighty Lord,
but subordinate to something else.
If out of love for living things and need for them he made the world,
why did he not make creation wholly blissful,
free from misfortune?
If he were transcendent, he would not create.
For he would be free.
Nor if he was involved in transmortification.
For then he would not be almighty.
Thus the doctrine that the world was created by God makes no sense at all.
And God commits great sin in slaying the children whom he himself created.
If you say that he slays only to destroy evil beings,
why did he create such beings in the first place?
Good men should combat the believer and
maddened by an evil doctrine.
Know that world is uncreated.
As time itself is,
without beginning and end.
And is based upon the principles, life and rest.
Uncreated and indestructible.
It endures under the compulsion of its own nature.
Divided into three sections.
Hell, earth.
Heaven and heaven.
Some foolish men declare that Creator made the world.
The doctrine that the world was created is ill-advised
and should be rejected.
If God created the world,
where was he before creation?
If you say he was transcendent, then,
and needed no support,
where is he now?
No single being had the skill to make this world.
For how can an immaterial God create that which is material?
How can God have made the world without any raw material?
If you say he made this first,
and then the world,
you are faced with the endless regression.
If you declare that this raw material arose naturally, you fall into another fallacy.
For the whole universe might thus have been its own creator,
and have arisen equally naturally.
If God created the world by an act of his own will,
without any raw material,
then it is just his will and nothing else.
But who will believe this silly stuff?
If he is ever perfect and complete, how could the will to create have arisen?
If,
on the other hand,
he is not perfect,
he could no more create the universe than a potter could.
I lost my place.
Formless.
If he is formless,
actionless,
and all embracing,
how could he have created the world?
Such a soul,
devoid of all modality,
would have no desire to create anything.
If he is perfect,
he does not strive for the three aims of man.
So what advantage would he gain by creating the universe?
If you say that he created to no purpose,
because it was his nature to do so,
then God is pointless.
If he created in some kind of sport,
it was the sport of a foolish child,
leading to trouble.
If he created because of the karma of embodied beings acquired in a previous creation, He is not the Almighty Lord.
But subordinate to someone else.
If our love for living things and need of them, he made the world.
Why did he not make creation wholly blissful?
Free from misfortune.
If he were transcendent, he would not create.
For he would be free.
Nor if involved in transmigration.
For then he would not be almighty.
Thus the doctrine that the world was created by God
makes no sense at all.
And God creates great sin in slaying the children whom he himself created.
If you say that he slays only to destroy evil beings,
why did he create such beings in the first place?
Good men should combat the believer in divine creation,
maddened by evil doctrine.
Know that the world is uncreated.
As time itself is.
Without a beginning and end.
And is based on the principles, life and rest.
Uncreated and indestructible, it endures under the compulsion of its own nature.
Divided into three sections.
Hell.
Earth.
And heaven.
Okay. What do you hear? What do you notice? What caught your ear as this thing zipped around? It seems to be somewhat of an argumentative track. Yes, oh, it is indeed. This is not a story. This is not a simple narrative. This is an argument. Okay?
Lots of questions.
Lots of questions behind the arguments. Because the questions are, in fact, not, gee, I wonder how. No, the questions are, in fact,
accusations.
Accusations, yes. Mm-hmm.
It seems to challenge the idea that a single creator is all-powerful, all-knowing, and all-present. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I get the feeling he hasn't met God.
Yes. Or, that's a piece to think about. Because he, in fact, rejects the notion of a creator, yes?
Well, I'm looking here, and this is before the birth of Christ. So I'm wondering, what is this a rejection of? What type of God? From what different branch or what different faith?
I think he seems to not, even if he would believe in God, he would have a hard time with this God. Mm-hmm. Because he's angry with any kind of a God that would act the way he does.
He makes the basic assumption that human reason can figure out the universe.
I think he sounds like the society we live in.
But he doesn't say there is no God because he's talking about it.
That's a piece that we do have to catch as it floats by in the breeze. It is intriguing to me that this argument is an aggressive argument against notions of God as creator, as manufacturer of world, but this is an argument that uses the word God as if it has meaning. Now that's a piece worth noticing just in our analysis of this sucker. What else?
I noticed that hell, earth, and heaven, so mm-hmm. he must believe in something related to the tune of God.
Or at least something that is not simply accessible to human being on the plane of earthly existence. This is a structured universe. Whatever world is created by this non-story, whatever world is created, it may not have a manufacturing God, but it has a structure that includes hell, earth, and heaven. That's intriguing. So that you have the word God as a term with meaning, and you have a structure that is in fact beyond human experience, which means that though reason is rolled out as the measure of all things, is it reasonable? Does one arrive at notions of heaven through reasoned argument? How in the world would one? Does one arrive at notions of hell through reasoned argument or through empirical experience? How in the world would one? That's intriguing. What else?
I'm intrigued by the thought of God as a kind of trickster, as a foolish child, leading to trouble.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. What does it do to have? Oh, I can't ask the question and get it right. That snags me too. What does it do to have that image of God dance in? What does that contribute? It means that the word God has some content, at least presumed content. Now again, I do not read the original language. I'm stuck with the English. Who knows what the original language might say? It could in fact be something, the whole problem that has intrigued us might be not there. That's always possible. That is in fact the case with some of the things that we study and tear our hair out over in Jewish scripture. It's just not there in the Hebrew. Oh well, might be. But since we're stuck with the English, God is a term that appears to have content, but God gets characterized as a foolish child, a troublemaker, maybe a trickster.
Maybe he thinks either in the Bible they got hell and earth wrong, well, hell and heaven wrong, and also maybe when you think of it, people usually don't follow foolish children.
Oh, that's a nice piece. God may be a character in this speaker's world, but God is a character that ought not be followed because God is a foolish child, as presented by those who say the Creator made the world. Now that may be a distinction that we shall need shortly here, because what you saw, what you said, I think matters. It is not a denial. There's nothing here that denies God. There's something here that denies stories told about God. And those stories are not to be followed. What else?
He does not strive for the three aims of man. First of all, did I miss something? Are they listed here?
They're not.
Or is this some kind of a moral argument going somewhere?
It might could. What do you know about the three aims of man? This is a story, this is a speaker out of India. This piece that we have was written, says the editor of this volume of Primal Myths is the name of the volume, and the editor is Barbara Sproul. I do not know how to pronounce her name for sure, so I've chosen it that way. And she says that this particular piece was written in the 9th century of the Common Era. But it is part of a tradition that goes back to many centuries before. It's an old enough faith to have been re-founded in the 6th century before the Common Era. So it's a part of a very old tradition. Does anybody know anything about Hindu notions of what human beings might aim at? Or Buddhist notions of what human beings might aim at? What do you know?
I know that the Buddha spoke of Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path, right living and so forth, and that human beings should strive to accept these truths in order to walk the Noble Eightfold Path and then become liberated and achieve that state of nirvana. Mm-hmm.
And that state consists in?
I've heard it described as stillness or stillness of wind.
To leverage off of that, Buddhism has been called atheistic because they believe that the nature of life is suffering and the goal is to get out of suffering. And since existence is suffering, your goal is to walk the Eightfold Path and be moral so that when reincarnation occurs, eventually your being can become non-existent and you won't be trapped in the cycle of pain anymore. So some Buddhists actually believe in a God, but it's not intrinsic in their religion.
Well, is this author not arguing the existence of God? Because at the very last sentence, he tells you that the world is uncreated from beginning and end. So there is no beginning and no end. So I don't think he's arguing whether there's a God or not. He's arguing whether there is creation or non-creation.
And that is crucial. The speaker may, in fact, from what we have here, this is all we're looking at, the speaker may in fact be very willing to draw the conclusion that there is no God, but the speaker uses the word God as if it has content. So that is probably not, we cannot draw the conclusion that the speaker is atheistic, but the speaker is surely a-creatorial or something like that. There is no creator, and if there is a meaningful content to God, it is not to be found in foolish stories of a God who does any of these things. because all of these things lead to fallacious thinking. What else do you know about the three aims?
Are they an Indian thing or a Jain thing?
We don't know from what we have here. But good assumptions are that the aims that he's speaking about will be the things that human beings strive for. And if there is a goal of Buddhist living, it is to cease striving.
So the three aims of man are imperfect, because if he is perfect, he does not strive for these things.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. And from the text, therefore, if he were trying to create something because he wanted to make, then he's imperfect, because he is subject to an aim that human beings have. If he were trying to create something because he wanted to acquire it, he is imperfect, because human beings seek to acquire. If he were trying to create something so that he could propagate himself, he is imperfect, because he is doing something that human beings try to draw to themselves.
He made some probably bad comparisons, but some comparisons with Greek mythology. You end up with gods, or a series of gods whose main attribute is apatheia, who are basically apathetic to the world. But you also end up with gods who are kind of, in some ways, cheap replicas of human beings, because they're so full of character flaws, problems. So if you transfer that maybe over into an Indian setting, which I'm sure you should do, but if you did that, you've got sort of a movement from Hinduism into Buddhism, where you do have sort of myriad gods. But in Buddhism, in some ways you leave them behind, in some ways you don't. But simply you recognize the limitations of that which is beyond.
And your caution at crossing cultures is altogether appropriate. And so, having noted the caution, let me bash through and be incautious. Whatever we're looking at here is not Mediterranean, but there is in Mediterranean thought the notion that human beings emerged from the swamp of superstition when philosophy arose. And what existed before in the swamp of superstition were the stories of the gods who desired and wanted and made and procreated and killed and cheated and did all the rest, and created a vast chaos of stories that in fact counteracted each other and made gods, in some cases, less worthy than human beings, just stronger. And out of that, say, the philosophers who believe that philosophy arose out of the swamp, out of that came Thales, who looked and said, we have around us a vast swamp of multiplicity. What's the one thing? And drew out of the multiplicity one thing that everything was made of and everything consisted in. And that one thing was water. Others said, no, not water, air. And my favorite Greek philosophers, Anaximenes is one of them. Because Anaximenes said, no, it's not water, as Thales said. It's in fact air. It's just some of it thicker than others. But the goal is to say there is not a multiplicity, there is a simplicity. And this argument may be making something similar. It's not Mediterranean, it's surely not Greek, it's not contemporaneous with any of this, but it may be a movement that is, in some senses, a cousin. Other Greek philosophers said, no, it's not water, it's not air, it's change. That's Heraclitus. All things are held together by change. The simple truth is, the one thing that is true of everything that exists is that it changes. When we lived in Wisconsin, we had cats. And our first two cats I named for my two favorite pre-Socratic philosophers, Anaximenes and Heraclitus. And then we got to know them better, and we changed their names to Leadhead and Brickbrain. But maybe this is doing the same thing as you see happening in a different culture at a different time. Maybe so. In which case, it is a careful rejection of the multiplicity of stories for the unity of, well, if this is a story that attempts to draw simplicity out of multiplicity, what is the simplicity that's being drawn here?
Change.
Could be. Change, right? He's got a pocket full of change. Hey, this is what you have 13-year-old children for. Is there a simplicity behind this argument anywhere?
The universe just is. Wasn't created, doesn't have a purpose, just is.
It just is.
Uncreated and indestructible.
Yes.
And deer is under the compulsion of its own nature.
Maybe the simplicity is the simple raw fact of existence, the simple raw fact of being, as uncreated as time is. What would it mean to live in this world? A world shaped by these arguments. Someone said that this sounds like a very contemporary argument. It does to me too. But it is a 10th century argument and not written in the language that I read. It always intrigues me when I find cousins of mine in arguments that come out of cultures and centuries and languages of which I am not a part. What would it mean, what would it be to live in this world? What would it mean to be a human being?
Well, you didn't have to spend much time dealing with the meaning of life.
Yes. Because life is.
Just is. There's no sense of why God put me here or why am I here. You just are.
You just are.
Yeah, but you also spend a lot of time arguing.
Yes. Which, of course, would make me feel right at home. But
and I don't find a lot of neutrality here because there's an edge. You know,
yes.
And when he says, good men should combat the believer in divine creation, bad men by an evil body. I mean, that's. Mm-hmm.
I agree with you. I think it's this person believes it's important to believe that God didn't create the universe. That's important. It's not like, hey, it's just an idle thing. It's important that you understand God did not create the universe.
Does that fit with what you're seeing?
Not sure. You're saying that it's important that there is no God.
Yeah.
Or that God didn't create.
There is no creative act.
Did you read the I don't know what you call this, the thing up here where it talks about
the itty bitty intro.
The itty bitty intro. It basically says the Jains may believe in gods, but they think they're irrelevant, essentially. But I happen to know that in India the Jains are a minority, but they're considered quite ethical people. So there must be something else that gets them to be ethical. You know, I think with our tradition, it's honoring God, knowing about God, knowing what God wants, being thankful to God. These are the things that help make us ethical, I think. So if you took, in our culture, if you took out God, you're taking out a big reason for being ethical, you know, for people to do things right.
Although as a historian, you could argue that in our culture, knowing what God wants and doing it is what makes us unethical as well. Because acting on the basis of what we know God wanted us to do may in fact yield terrible action and has frequently and repeatedly.
I think the Jainist is saying here are like various misunderstandings of a creator God, and I think implicitly then it's, and there are really bad side effects of each of those things. So it might be an ethical argument, or an argument that it's more ethical to not believe in this type of God, because if you believe in this type of God, then what follows is unethical.
What is there a shape to what is unethical? Can I grab that and squeeze that? Because I hear something there that I want to hear a lot more of. Because there is an edge to this, and it could be that he's simply cranky, but let's give him the benefit of the doubt and say he's up to something, then he has a shape to his ideas.
Well, if there is no creative act, then we have no obligations to a creator, then to whom do we in fact have obligations?
Yes.
Is it other human beings? Is it, I mean, who knows?
Yeah. That would be a possibility. It could be that the obligation is to other human beings.
One thing that I know from the History Channel is there's stuff that we found out because we tried to find back when maybe God created us, but by this, we wouldn't have thought of those things because we think we are just here.
Ah.
We don't really, we wouldn't care.
So it might be that in this culture there would be no History Channel.
Right.
Because we would not
mm-hmm.
quest after origins.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Interesting idea, my son.
I was thinking if because of the path you live, you try to get to less suffering, and that becomes more godlike. But if they don't like, if he doesn't like what God is, why would you try to do that?
Yeah. Or what gods have been said to be, what gods have been storied to be.
Mm-hmm.
He surely does not like that. What would make for ethics in, where would proper behavior pay? I can't talk English. How would you derive a notion of what proper behavior, what human behavior is, in a world created by this argument? Now, we have way too small a sample. Yeah, I know that. We have a sample.
Well, I briefly studied Jainism
yes.
in an Eastern religions course in
yes.
history. For the Jainist, is cyclical.
Yes.
I want to say it was, it's known as samsara. This cyclical sense of time in which, you know, the universe has and always has been, and everything just goes in a pattern. You start at the top of the cycle, and everything is good, and it progressively becomes worse and worse and worse and worse, and then eventually becomes better and better and better.
Mm-hmm.
And from what my instructor informed me, every period is about 10,000 years, or I'm probably butchering this, but we're getting close to a terrible point in the existence of the universe. And we need to liberate ourselves from this continuous cycle of pain and then happiness and pain and happiness and pain and happiness. And how we do that is by removing ourselves from bad karma, which we accumulate because we destroy elements of nature, elements of this ever-continuing, ever-existing universe.
Mm-hmm. So ethics would consist in, or would be shaped by, by
treating all matter, all living beings with care, not destroying life.
Mm-hmm.
Hence why Jainists sweep everywhere they go.
Mm-hmm.
They believe that even in killing microscopic organisms, that they accumulate bad karma.
Mm-hmm. So ethics consists in an absolute sense, doing no harm.
Mm-hmm.
That sounds a lot like, I'm not sure if it was Buddhist or Hindu or,
mm-hmm.
it was one of those two. They don't believe in killing anything
mm-hmm.
whatsoever.
This
because
is a related faith. This is a related
maybe.
Faith.
Two comments. With the comment you just made about doing no harm, just thinks, I mean, that's verbatim scripture. Love does no harm, therefore love is the fulfillment of the law. Interesting thought. The line, know that the world is uncreated as time itself without beginning and end. So in this world, it's not God that is eternal, but the world that's eternal. Therefore, it's not through honoring God's will, but through honoring the will of the world, which would apparently, you know, what then one could explore, what is the will of the world?
Yes.
To grow, to flourish, and then honoring, that connects back to the honoring.
I don't know if
the will
of the world. It's like the world has rules. It doesn't have a will, it just has rules. You know?
That's what I mean. I'm
and I guess you were describing one of the rules as cycle, and then another rule is you shouldn't be killing animals. Whatever, it's not like there's a will implies.
I'm using that metaphor.
Or something.
Yeah.
Well, the universe, I mean, if you believe that all time is cyclical, and the idea is that, you know, you will be continuously reborn and die, and continue to be reborn and die for the rest of eternity, which is a long time, and I can't even fathom that, but it says here, you know, in the little text before this passage, that the goal is to have one's jiva, or soul, released from the cycle of rebirth in a state of isolated, eternal, and omniscient inactivity. So the goal is to stop moving with this
with the circle.
Ever continuous cycle.
Because the cycle is driven by the doing of harm.
Yes.
The cycle is eternal, but the world is a condition of doing harm. Mm-hmm. And as long as harm is done, the cycle continues. And so the goal is to land in the safe, the still center. I don't know that they draw it this way, but allow me. Where you do no harm, and therefore do not continue the cyclical endlessness.
And I like what Justin discussed about, you know, this idea that it's we will serve the natural order of the world. We will follow that. We will follow the eternal, you know, flow of nature as opposed to an eternal God. Because it seems as though the world is more tangible. The world can be seen with our own eyes, and we can see how the world operates as opposed to God.
In terms of argument and diatribe, stories can be destructive and stories can be constructive. And I think part of the question that may arise is, are the stories that come out of religion, are they constructive stories or destructive stories? In terms of some of the books being written now that seem to be very heavy critiques of religion and faith, are they really critiques of religion and faith, or are they critiques of bad stories coming out of religion and faith?
And this argument intends to slice open bad stories and leave them bleeding on the ground. That for sure. And whatever else, it intends to leave bad stories bleeding on the ground.
Well, I think.
Just to respond to your question really quickly, I've read a couple of those commentaries on, you know, why religion is bad, particularly Sam Harris's End of Faith novel, and I think he's more focused on the actual practitioners of the religious faith. And he tends to lump all Christians and all Muslims into a single category, which isn't fair, but I think he associates all Christians as being bad because there are Christians who might butcher the gospel.
I think part of the problem is why we're bad practitioners is because we may have a bad story.
True.
Or
true.
We may have an ineffective story or an incomplete story.
Well, I think as we age, we lose our childlike faith. And we don't rely on accepting it as face value or on the faith principle. So then we start to question and enter into that realm of, well, I'm an adult, I can think for myself, or I can read all these different articles and try to come up with some hybrid of all these different stories, when if we just keep our childlike faith, and getting back to, rather than arguing, was the world created by a creator or not, just accept the fact that it exists in the form that it exists, and allow the Creator, as many of us, our own fathers or mothers, to watch out for us, have our best interest in mind. It's just like the laws of physics. If some of you have studied physics, how did they arrive? Do we just accept the fact that gravity is gravity? You can deny it. You can hate it, but you can simply lift an apple and drop it. And there's the proof. How it got there, we have all kinds of reasons, scientific and elsewise, but the laws of physics, they don't care if you're a smart student or a not smart student. They don't care if you're a drunk driver or a sober driver. There's certain laws of physics that take place regardless of who you are.
And this story says it's the laws of physics. Just out of personal experience, the one thing that I was squirming on was the childlike piece, if only because in our four children, childlike faith never meant unquestioning. Our children always ask questions, harder when they were little. I sometimes wonder if what childlike faith actually is that absolute freedom to question that we very carefully sand down so that they ask housebroken questions by the time they get to school. But every once in a while, I get a student at Augustana who hasn't been properly housebroken, and I love it. Because they ask questions that in fact sound very like questions that little kids ask. Where does God go to the bathroom? Well, that's a goofy little question, but it in fact implies all manner of things about location and divinity, materiality and immateriality, that have actual serious ramifications if you actually follow them through. But laws of physics is a big deal. We have 5 minutes. May I ask you, I'm going to read you Genesis 1 again. And if I could ask this half to listen and derive and figure out which questions the Jainist questioner would ask of Genesis 1. And if I could ask this half to pretend that Genesis 1 is a Jainist story. Now that's of course impossible. I'm asking you to do something ridiculous. But as long as we know it's ridiculous, let's just do it. Listen for the way this story answers. The way this story might embody something that the Jainist speaker would approve of. Maybe that the answer in the end is not a blasted thing. All right. But listen just in case. Okay? You got the scam? Let me read. In the beginning, when God began to create the heavens and the earth was a formless void, and darkness covered the face of the deep, while the wind from God swept over the face of the waters. Then God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. And God saw that the light was good, and God separated the light from the darkness. God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. And there was evening, and there was morning, the first day. And God said, "Let there be a dome in the midst of the waters, and let it separate the waters from the waters." So God made the dome and separated the waters that were under the dome from the waters that were above the dome, and it was so. And God called the dome sky, and there was evening, and there was morning, the second day. And God said, "Let the waters under the sky be gathered together into one place, and let the dry land appear." And it was so. God called the dry land earth, and the waters that were gathered together he called seas, and God saw that it was good. Then God said, "Let the earth put forth vegetation, plants yielding seed, and fruit trees of every kind on earth that bear fruit with the seed in it." And it was so. The earth brought forth vegetation, plants yielding seed of every kind, and trees of every kind bearing fruit with the seed in it. And God saw that it was good. And there was evening, and there was morning, the third day. And God said, "Let there be lights in the dome of the sky to separate the day from the night, and let them be for signs and for seasons and for days and years. And let them be lights in the dome of the sky to give light upon the earth." And it was so. God made the two great lights, the greater light to rule the day and the lesser light to rule the night and the stars. God set them in the dome of the sky to give light upon the earth, to rule over the day and over the night, and to separate the light from the darkness. God saw that it was good. And there was evening and there was morning, the fourth day. And God said, "Let the waters bring forth swarms of living creatures, and let birds fly above the earth across the dome of the sky." So God created the great sea monsters, and every living creature that moves, and of every kind with which the waters swarm, and every winged bird of every kind. And God saw that it was good, and God blessed them, saying, "Be fruitful and multiply, and fill the waters and the seas, and let the birds multiply on the earth." And there was evening and there was morning, the fifth day. And God said, "Let the earth bring forth living creatures of every kind, cattle and creeping things and wild animals of the earth of every kind." And it was so. God made the wild animals of the earth of every kind, and the cattle of every kind, and everything that creeps upon the earth of every kind. And God saw that it was good. God said, "Let us make humankind in our image, according to our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the air, and over the cattle, and over all the wild animals of the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps upon the earth." So God created humankind in his image. In the image of God, he created them, male and female, he created them. God blessed them. God said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply, and fill the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the air, and over every living thing that moves upon the earth." God said, "See, I've given you every plant yielding seed that is upon the face of all the earth, and every tree with seed in its fruit, and you shall have them for food. And every beast of the earth, and every bird of the air, and everything that creeps on the earth, everything that has the breath of life, I've given every green plant for food." And it was so. God saw everything that he had made, and indeed, it was very good. And there was evening, and there was morning, the sixth day. Thus the heavens and the earth were finished, and all their multitude, and on the seventh day God finished the work that he had done, and he rested on the seventh day from all the work that he had done. So God blessed the seventh day and hallowed it, because on it God rested from all the work that he had done in creation. What two questions? might the arguer ask?
Pulling something out of this text that we've read, if God is indeed perfect, why would God need to create anything else in the universe?
Yes, why would God need to? Good question. And a question that might be interesting to bump around here, because the story very carefully does not answer that question at all. Why does God need to? There's no statement of need. Nice.
Where it begins is in the beginning.
Yes.
Which suggests a commencement, somehow separate in time. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
But if God said it was good, why isn't it?
Yes.
God kept saying.
Or is God stand, are God's standards so low? Okay, now, what three things, two things, however many things, might sound Jainist? Anybody find anything that sounds so?
The phrase, let there be, .. Wise.
Yes. And so there are statements of existing things that simply are. And while let there be is a jussive in Hebrew, it is somehow like an imperative, it is in fact a statement of what is. Okay, very nice.
It has always been good.
It has always been good. And if this is a statement of beginning, we'll have to figure out what to do with beginning in circular time, but as long as the circle is going, it is good.
Our image?
Ooh, how do you mean?
In there you read.
Yes.
And let's create them in our image.
Yep. Do you hear something Jainist in that, or just something intriguing?
It seemed, he must be some dormant.
Oh.
Or something.
Oh.
Because our, there has to be two or more.
Yes, he's trying to say the plural form, not singular. Our means there must be two or three gods.
Yes, yes, therefore there are gods and gods. And perhaps a whole hierarchy of gods who are irrelevant. Wouldn't that be fascinating? How about this? A couple of little pieces just as a break and run. One of the things that characterizes discussions, not necessarily the most productive discussions, about ethics in Western culture is the notion that ethics in Western culture are grounded in the notion of linearity. There is an offense that is followed by a counteraction, and therefore you make ethical decisions by standing at this point and judging what it would take to get to that point without counteractions intervening, impinging upon you. That's not the best sketch of Western ethics, but it's a sketch. Linearity is often played as the key to Western understandings of ethics in all things. Do you notice that this is not a linear story? It is a circular story, very carefully covering the entire compass of the week, which then re-begins and re-begins and re-begins. When the rabbis tell stories about Genesis, they say, why is it that God rests on the seventh day? The Holy One, blessed be He, can't be tired. Why could God rest? Why does God rest on the seventh day? Why would that be that God would rest on the seventh day? Ah, say the rabbis, it's obvious. God rests on the seventh day because it's Shabbat. That means that the cycle is even earlier than God. Say the rabbis. And they say it because this story allows them to. Now that's interesting. Second break and run piece. If Jainists live their lives to do no harm to any sentient being, to push it further than we've gone, but that would be a reasonable statement, they will surely not step upon them, nor will they eat them. What is food according to this story? What are all human beings to eat, and what are all animals and every creeping thing and every bird of the air to eat? Only plants. This is a story that does not suppose that carnivorous behavior is proper to the world that has been created and runs in a cycle.
But
I am a carnivore. I am an omnivore. I like a well-prepared piece of protein. But this story does not give me a place to stand. because this story says, I've given you green plants for your food.
But to keep the plants in line, so then they don't get too hectic, there has to be plant eaters, which means to keep them in line, there has to be meat eaters.
That is how it works. This is why you have 13-year-old children.
And keep both of them in line, carnivores.
But this story does not presuppose that you need carnivores.
Looking at this story from that other story, there's also a kind of a suggestion here that maybe God is not doing so much creating as we think. The let there be and the let there, let the earth bring forth. It's the earth that brings forth the things. It's the earth bring the sea that brings forth the fish. It is the earth that brings forth human beings. All God does is give permission for those things to happen.
Which might, in fact, be something like let it fall and the laws of physics.
A few months ago, I attended an entomology class at the University of Minnesota, and we were studying where have the honeybees been disappearing and the mass dying off of honeybees. And being an animal scientist and studying cause and effects and cycles, this professor, with a lot of documentation, stated that if all the insects in the world were to be extinguished now, that the human race would disappear within 5 years because of the symbiotic relationship that insects provide pollination. Right now, the almond crop in the state of California is about 500,000 acres. It's projected to reach 750,000 acres in the next few years. At the present time, we do not have enough commercial bees in the United States to pollinate just almonds, let alone the blueberries in Maine, the pumpkin patches up and down the East Coast. This is a very interesting when you study cause and effects and let the earth be and how the earth has a way of cleansing itself. And I do remember one philosopher, not the person's name, but the statement was, there's not one problem that cannot be solved with either an increase or decrease in population. I don't know what the philosopher was, but it was the...
I disagree with the very final thing of the Janus story.
Yes?
And that is that the earth is indestructible.
That of what?
That the earth is indestructible.
Oh.
Aren't there theories within physics that suggest that the universe continues to expand and then reaches a point where it begins retracting?
That's one of the sketches. Yep. Which, and we need to break and run so that we can, but if in fact the universe is all the matter that it is in whatever state and contraction or decontraction, collapse or expansion that it might be, the universe exists indestructibly, but there could be no human beings in it very easily.
Yeah. Earth as we know it is destructible, but Earth itself may be indestructible.
So matter is indestructible.
Yes,
the matter
is indestructible.
Only transfer.
Thank you so much. This is just a hoop. Thank you very much.